Thank you for joining us, everybody. This is the Merge Medical Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff Brown, with my co-host, Dr. Jeff Cole. We're joined today by Rob Bohawks. He is the CEO of Researchify Health, which is looking to use an AI solution to automate most of the redundant tasks in clinical research. Rob, thanks a bunch for joining us. Tell us about Researchify Health.
Yeah, thank you both for having me on your podcast today. So I had a chance to build Researchify Health about 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, into a fairly commercial product today. And I've spent my career in the clinical trial landscape about 16 years building two companies in the space. And one of the things I realized was that, one, we're still not moving the needle and getting more patients in the clinical trials. And number two is that we're putting more work onto the plates of research team members, and we're not really automating the tasks they have to manage patient outreach, pre-screening on a consistent basis. And I'm happy to jump a little bit more into the details there, but ultimately, you know, we live in a world where clinical trials are the gateway to approve new medicines. Just a quick background, I lost my dad to ALS about 5 years ago. My mom will probably pass away from cancer in the next maybe 90 days. Like, we just don't have effective treatments for the majority of the disease we're managing. It's not because we don't have the R&D efforts. It's the fact that we have 78,000 ongoing clinical trials in the U.S., and about 95% of them are behind on clinical trial enrollment by like 1 to 3 or 4 years. So we have to think about how do we develop products that supports the research site's opportunity to accelerate clinical trial enrollment. And we'll maybe dive a little bit deeper into what happens at a site today, but also maybe building a company that supports the acceleration of drug development.
That's awesome to hear. It sounds like, you know, this is definitely a problem that needed solving. First of all, let me tell you, sorry about both your parents. It's a tough thing to go through, but that definitely is a motivating factor for someone, I would imagine. But this seems like clinical trials, and I've been involved in several of them. There's so much red tape. If you don't know, for those that are listening, the bureaucracy, the redundancy, it seems like it's almost like the problem was made for an AI solution. And it seems like that's what you're trying to do.
Yeah, maybe I'll talk in specifics of oncology. Our technology supports a broad range of therapeutic indications, but oncology is an important one for all of us, right? 39% of people in the U.S. will develop cancer sometime in their lifetime. So let's just maybe talk about that for 30 seconds. Today, it takes 12.3 years from first patient dose to commercialize a cancer drug. And we know by far that 12.3 years is way too long for any cancer patients, realistically. And if we look at what one of the key causalities there, I think CROs and sponsors have gotten the ability to get trials deployed more quickly. We'll go through contracting and regulatory steps more quickly, but we're still really stuck on this patient enrollment side of things. And the numbers today, and unfortunately, I think it's been stagnant for the last probably 7 or 8 years, is that only 4% of adult cancer patients participate in clinical trials, 4%. And if we just move that to 10%, then we can shorten that 12.3 years down to about 7 years, which is remarkable. And today there's 19,000 ongoing interventional cancer clinical trials in the US alone. And if I kind of dive where our product really helps, is I'm sure you've seen protocols and you probably looked at some public criteria for enrolling cancer clinical trials, but the eligibility criteria is incredibly complex, right? Mm-hmm. You gotta be, 35 inclusion criteria, 30 exclusion criteria, and then you have a cancer patient whose disease changes month over month. They're not the same patient every day, right? Sometimes you have a better month and your ECOG performance status has improved. Sometimes you're in a lot of pain in a specific month and your performance status drops, just as one example, and your lab values are moving. So trying to align when a patient can enroll into a clinical trial with the patient's disease and with the protocol amendment that site is on, I just can't believe that it's even happening today manually, and how difficult that is as a site to constantly contact patients, get a response, how are you feeling this month, and trying to align the data sets for that patient to qualify. So if we can just automate the outbound communication to the cancer patients, help them with that timing and navigation with the help of AI, we can significantly reduce the amount of work that's taken on by the coordinator primarily at that site so that we can get that cancer patient enrolled, of course.
If you had the ability to poll all cancer patients with a really simple, maybe one question survey, you know, would you be interested in participating in a trial? I can't imagine that people in that situation would say no. I mean, is that the answer, you think? Or
that is the answer. Yeah, 83% of adults believe in cancer that clinical trials should be a part of their standard of care process. So by far, the majority of cancer patients think they should at least be offered clinical trials and they can make that decision. But the reality says, you know, you've got these major academic centers like UCLA, UCI, UCSD, and Southern California that participate in oncology clinical trials, of course. But then the private practices, which see 90% of the cancer patients across the country, right, those are pretty spotty in terms of how many of them conduct trials. So ultimately, what I'm trying to say is patients are going to institutions or sites that are just not providing clinical trials. And there's a lot of companies that are trying to help those sites become research friendly or get involved with clinical trials. So if we can then support those sites on top of the existing ones, with the fact that, hey, we'll take all of these elements off your plate, then we can radically improve access to clinical trials as well.
What are the economics there? Because if a practice is already struggling just to see the patients and get their dictations done and all of the work with pre-certification, et cetera, is there any financial help for participating?
Yeah. So our technology, we have a couple of case studies. You know, we generate a return on investment. So when we help bring, right, 5, 6, 7 new patients to a site, let's say over a period of like 3 or 4 months, which doesn't sound like a lot, but the financial value of a research patient to a site is, you know, on the low end, maybe $7,000-$8,000 per patient enrolled. In oncology, it's more like $50,000 per patient that we help enroll. So there's significant economic impact if we enroll more patients in trials, so that those sites don't have to suffer and lose, look at clinical trials as something that is not a profit center, or at least breaks even for them. A lot of sites and institutions don't conduct clinical trials for monetary value. In fact, they typically have money losing elements within their practices. We can help change that just by getting more patients into clinical trials for them. And it's a numbers game, right? So if we look at our very successful case studies, on behalf of a small research institution, which we can typically double clinical trial enrollment, which is pretty amazing, by the way. We've got a long ways to go, but that number is already very exciting for them. You know, their bread and butter is going to be enrolling patients, and it's impossible for a team member to contact 10,000, 12,000, 20,000 patients across the community in a single month without a huge call center. So we just take away some of that work through automation and SMS-based communication.
Tell me, let's dial it back a little bit. Like, you talked about losing your dad and your mom's basically on hospice is what it sounds like.
Close, but yeah.
Did you just wake up one day and said, hey, you know, clinical trials need help? Because for those that haven't done them, I mean, I've been involved in IRB and clinical trials and so forth. It's definitely there's definitely problems there that need fixing. And like I was telling Jeff Cole offline, it's almost like this was built for that. But did you just wake up one day and say, hey, this is I got a solution for this and it's going to be AI or what?
Great question. So back in like 2007, I was helping a company here in Denver raise capital. They were in the clinical trial space. Fast forward a couple of years, I joined the company full time, worked my way up pretty quickly as CEO, turned that company around, and I was a clinical trial company specifically providing services and technology to support their clinical trial needs. So that was how I entered the clinical trial space about 16 years ago. After that company was sold, I founded another software company called ClinOne that was a global system that once patients were on a clinical trial, our technology helped them stay on trial, right? We had integration with Uber Health. Transportation's a big deal. We can consent patients remotely. We can manage their dosing compliance at home. So that was a software that was really dedicated toward once a patient was on study. And during the time when I was at ClinOne, I was also managing my dad and in ALS, and as you probably know, there's no effective treatments for ALS even today, certainly no cure. So clinical trials were the option, and I was trying to get a hold of UCLA, UCI, all the major academic centers across Southern California, and I just couldn't believe how difficult it was to even get a hold of a coordinator that could navigate me to one of their clinical trials. And I'm not being disrespectful to those institutions, they're just busy, but it literally took me a month or longer to get a hold of a human being at those sites. So I just wanted to know, what clinical trial do you have for ALS this month that would potentially see if my dad was eligible? And then if you wanted an update on that, you have to go through the same process. And again, it's because those teams at those sites are so busy doing other activities, compliance, monitoring, business, drug accountability, right? They're just pulled in 50 different directions. So I told myself one day, I'm going to focus one company on solving this critical challenge around clinical trial enrollment. There's no reason why I should be able to sign up to an institution, get a text message once a month about clinical trials, and then an AI bot helps me navigate what clinical trials I'm eligible for right now. So that was the impetus, you know, kind of my personal challenges. And of course, the macro problems still exist in the community today.
So it sounds like just like there are more patients that would like to be involved, there probably are quite a few physicians as well. So I can see where you're solving for a pain point if you do help those people with awareness and onboarding into helping get their patients into those studies. And I've Jeff's been involved in clinical research. I really never have, but all of this is exciting. It's got me thinking about, you know, if we can make it easier, because there are, you know, I get asked by cardiologists from time to time to take a synovial sample, you know, from a small carpal tunnel incision, to look for amyloidosis and the effects in cardiac, the effects in Alzheimer and mental. I mean, I did a search. There's several studies going on, and how easy it would be for me to take a little synovial sample on every patient that agrees to get that done. Right. So I think there are a lot of people in private practice that would certainly be interested in getting more involved in clinical research, especially if we just had awareness and, you know, the launch pad was easy and we just understood, you know, what are the legal ramifications, what are the financial ramifications, just what, you know, jumping into a lane that we're not particularly used to swimming in.
Right.
I think
there's a lot of opportunity. I think as I mentioned earlier, the ability to evolve this product down the road. So it really handles a lot of the risk on behalf of the site. So if you can manage revenue, which is our business, right? We bring you more patients and you can fill your pipeline to support the cost of clinical trials, which is really important. But in the future, right? If you can just bring AI in to support this transformation at a site level, to de-risk that site, that means we can get private provider physicians who can very quickly move into the world of clinical trials successfully, right? That would be an optimal opportunity mm-hmm. for us as a company. Again, we want to stay focused for the first couple of years and be the very best that we can. But there is a very slippery slope here. Where our product started out and where our sites, which are great feedback mechanisms, are telling us where they need help is really fascinating, right? So a lot of our growth into more than patient outreach and pre-screening has all come from sites like, oh, can you solve these three things for us? They're so important. And that's what the best evolution of your product is. When your clients, you're help guiding you into the next module. So I'm excited about that, if you can imagine.
I would, through some local efforts here, something we talked about offline a little bit, I've become more aware of this space, clinical research organizations. Some of our listeners may not know. Can you explain what clinical research organizations do? And was that what your first company was technically in that space?
Yeah, I'll tell you about my first company because it was a bit ahead of its time. So the company was called Pharmatech Oncology, and we built a private community network of oncology practices. Pretty common today, but back 16 years ago, that wasn't very common. Because if you're at Pfizer, you're going to choose a UCLA to open your clinical trial. You're not going to use that oncology site in Billings, Montana. Like, we don't see enough patients. You're not a big institution. You may not be able to enroll fast enough. But we learned, of course, is that there's a lot of motivation to help support those community-based practices and getting them involved in clinical trials. And unlike UCLA, they're not trying to compete with 1,000 clinical trials at an institution like that, right? So you have maybe 10 open, and they tend to spend a lot of time focusing on those trials. A couple of things we did with that company that was innovative. Number one is it takes about a year or 6 months to activate a clinical trial site, which is a long time. And just how long it takes for contracting. So we built a model that was central contracting and central budgeting for these sites. And then we would activate a clinical trial once we've identified that patient in a matter of 10 days. That seemed a little crazy for our sites, and that certainly seemed a little crazy for our sponsors. So we work with all these institutions to modify their SLPs and change how we get drug delivery over to the site and how we get monitoring visits incorporated, because we were able to prove that you can enroll patients much more faster than if you had the traditional model, right? Because you're working with institutions that are in the community, which is important. And then number two, you're able to buy step aside the critical processes that these major institutions have in the slow elements of budget and contract negotiations. The second thing that we did, which again, a bit ahead of its time, is our patients in the community setting, we started to provide molecular profiling for them. That was when some of those early next generation sequencing companies like Foundation Medicine were very first approved. So we can understand some of the genomic underlying issues of your cancer type. And that was, again, that was a bit ahead of its time, but we started to profile these patients as a part of being in our network. So we had data on which patient had a KRAS mutation or which patient has a HER2 mutation. And so when it came to clinical trial recruitment, we can tell our sponsors, look, we've got X amount of patients at this center with this particular biomarker, and we help navigate that process. In fact, that was the reason that company was acquired, because the central lab company was so interested in providing this value to the patients once they take their next generation sequencing, they ended up buying that company. But really just helped accelerate enrollment and accelerated access to patients. The third component of that, I'm sorry if I'm going down the weeds here, but you know, recently, as of last year, the FDA has specific mandates on including a diversity plan for clinical trials. We can't just go to the Manhattans of the world where we are enrolling educated white individuals. You know, we need a diversity that represents the population in the US in terms of genetic profiling as well as genetic diversity. So now clinical trials typically need to include some planning around how we're going to tap into the underserved communities, right? How do we tap into Native American communities and the Asian communities and the Hispanic communities and put that into your planning of where you're going to actually activate those trial sites? So things have changed quite a bit. And then, of course, our AI product can speak unlimited languages, which is a huge piece alone. That's a huge barrier today. So patients can have that conversation in our natural language. And then we retranslate that language when it goes to the coordinator who may not speak, be fluent in, one of the specific languages.
Wow. So you mentioned your AI product. I think this maybe this is a good time to dive into that. How does that plug in?
Yes.
And to these other things we're talking about. Because I would think company number one, I would think you're working with companies like that. True?
We are working with site management organizations and research networks. Absolutely. And one of my two companies that I built, both solved the problem, but it created a problem because the sites had to use another product. Right. That was one of my challenges. And I look back, kind of self-assess of how I could have done things better. It was a solution that sites had to use for it to work effectively with their patients and become more efficient and allow patients to participate remotely, et cetera. So I'm kind of looking at the issues now. And not only do we have clinical trial enrollment issues and retention issues, we also have like major issues where sites are under-supported from a human capital perspective. There are probably fewer people in clinical trials than there were before the pandemic. There's a ton of burnout. A lot of people left. They're still burnout today. So building Research for Health, I wanted to create a technology that did a lot of work on behalf of the site without needing the site's involvement. So basically what our technology does today, it speaks to tens of thousands of patients in the community at that particular institution. We keep those patients engaged about clinical trials. When a patient says, yes, I'm interested in participating, we use a chat bot to get that patient pre-screened for the eligibility. And then only kind of at a late stage, I've got an interested patient, maybe qualified, do we send that referral over to the coordinator to say, great, out of the thousands of patients we've spoken to, you've got 11 patients who may be eligible for one of your trials today. And therefore we limit all that administrative work up front and hand off that very qualified patient toward the end.
Yeah, that's tremendous. When did you first start building the product, and where are you now with regard to commercialization and usage?
Yeah, so I started developing the product sometime in April of 2023. We had a MVP product at the beginning of 2024, so we're pretty new. Started commercializing back in January. We started generating revenue in the spring of 2024, so about 6 months ago. And really kind of thought through our AI product, which gets commercialized in January of next year. So basically, we started off with a basic chatbot that works better than I thought it would work in being able to generate additional patients for our site. And then our AI version of our product goes live in January 2025. And it's amazing. I've had the privilege of working with major academic centers, which typically don't move very quickly, but you know, they're seeing the value, which is great. The ability to really help some of the independent research sites, which, you know, they only make their revenue as a whole institution on enrollment of patients, that makes sense. And then some of the hospital groups as well. So I've been interested to see the feedback by different account types, whether it's a hospital, university, a health system, a children's hospital, or an independent research site of some of the networks as well.
So Rob, I can see where this podcast could go for hours with the detail that I would like to understand, yeah. But can you tell me just in a succinct manner, you've got this chat bot and then you partner with XYZ institution. Do you have to retrain this chat bot for each group, doctor group, institution, or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, I'll try to take like just 2 minutes so you can see what that looks like. Our most successful sites, we sign a BAA with the sites, right? And some sites are very open to that. I've got a few sites that are probably not so open to that, so that we can import their active patient lists at that institution. Typically limited information, first name, mobile number, and their primary indication. So we import that under a BAA into our technology. Our technology then starts to send out monthly communication that says, hey, welcome to clinical trials at Lee Valley. I'm going to send you a once a month update about the clinical trials. You can navigate the clinical trials. And once you're interested, we can help you navigate that trial specifically. So then under a BAA, we start to communicate with all of their active patients every single month. A patient looks at our communication. And currently we have like a 0.1% unsubscribe rate, which is very low in the world of technology. Patient says, I'm interested in a specific clinical trial. Then they throw an interactive text. We screen the patient by a series of questions that we ask them in terms of a relevance for the studies that are taking place at that institution. That conversation can take place, again, an infinite number of languages. And we're also adding the capability for a patient to take a picture or a screenshot of their medical records and include them in that text message, which our system can actually read and digest and match to the clinical trials at that site. Which is remarkable itself. I'm kind of scared and excited about the capability. We use OpenAI as our backend AI partner, and I'm just staggered by the ability of this product. A patient can have a million questions back and forth. If we can help them navigate basic things like what's an informed consent, how long is this trial going to take, you know, what's a placebo, we can help answer all of those very initial questions on top of the ability to match them to the right clinical trial. When a patient completes the 15 pre-screening questions, we send the report over to the coordinator. Remember, coordinators are very busy doing lots of other things. And we say, I've got a new patient that's interested. Based on the 10 trials you have open at your site right now, the patient is eligible by 97% based on their feedback for the following two trials. But there's two more questions to ask these patients. And we even help guide the site staff of what open questions they have on the exact qualification of that patient as well. And then we will have the ability to schedule that patient as well. So there'll be a button in there. Coordinator says, yep, it's a good patient. Let's schedule. And then we take over the communication for scheduling that patient. And then we will also integrate with Uber Health. So if the patient needs transportation coming into the site. So for example, for our trials for obesity, where a patient may have type 2 diabetes, they may have mobility challenges or be visually impaired, they may not be driving. We want to lower the barrier for all of those patients to participate so we can schedule and manage transportation all in like one very simple loop. And, you know, we're talking about saving 5, 10, 15 hours per patient to that site coordinator by this automation. And we can do it very, very effectively versus the coordinators could be out sick and you're in the backup coordinator. So we just be much more consistent as well.
I didn't know there was an Uber Health, but it seems like all of these big tech companies are recognizing that there's gold in the healthcare. And
yeah, there is. Yep. And then when you choose your, in my previous company, ClinOne, we offered Uber Health as a part of our transportation as well for patients. And I love seeing that get used because sometimes, by the way, when you're a patient and you can't drive, you may not be able to drive when you're on study, right? There's some challenges sometimes. So we're solving not only enrollment issues, but retention issues as well. But it's amazing. Uber Health is a plugin to an API, so it's easy to use. Mm-hmm. It selects a very high criteria of driver scoring. And then you can even select if a driver has like wheelchair accessible vehicle, things like that. So you can actually pre-select that during your scheduling.
Wow.
Great. What about issues around the data, ownership of it? Is there any risk of patients, you know, uploading information that the insurance companies get a hold of and it dings them somehow?
Great question. Not at the moment. And up until 2024, OpenAI was able to use the information you uploaded to them as a part of their learning model. And they've had some significant product updates here in the last 9 months, which really helps our relationship that says we can disable the element where it says that any of the patient's information is kept. So nothing is kept by OpenAI that we upload back and forth in a conversation. Of course, we have a series of security standards that we follow. And we get information from the patient or their EHR from the patient, or if they take a photo of their lab values from the patient. And it's all self-consented by the patient. So we don't have to worry about the issues between us and the site and whether we have consent to get this information as well.
You feel like there's any need to have a contingency plan or a backup AI or just all in on OpenAI?
Yeah, good question. I think we'll definitely have a secondary vendor lined up. I think OpenAI is going to be the big winner for the time being, particularly from their big investments from Microsoft. But undoubtedly, Google will have their they probably already have it. I haven't paid attention. OpenAI tends to be a good independent company away from the big companies, you know, the Facebooks and the Google and the Microsoft today, even though Microsoft's made a very large equity investment into them previous.
Yeah, we've had two other guests that were deeply involved with healthcare and AI. One was the author of ChatGPT MD, and the other was on the, I think it was on the OpenAI's healthcare platform, was he not, Jeff, if I'm remembering correctly?
So. Robert Pearl, out of Kaiser
Permanente. Yeah. Anyway, when we had these two guests on each time, it was exciting, but it's also a little bit scary. Some of the things they were saying about how fast the technology is accelerating. And so you're right in the trenches with it. I want to ask you, like, it's 2024, where do you see this? Five years from now, what will your platform be able to do in 3 years, 5 years?
I think reality says we want to start and stay very focused initially as business and not get too wide and lose our direction. But I completely foresee that AI and the replacement of some of this human staff can take away, you know, probably 70% of the labor force required to manage clinical trials, which is a good thing. Yeah. It's because we don't have enough team members. Right. We don't have enough staff in research. So we're going to replace their jobs, but we can just do two or three times the amount of clinical trials in half the time than we can today. So, right today we have an AI bot. Our technology is called Jane. Jane manages outreach, communication, pre-screening, and scheduling. But imagine that we have another technology then that can help a patient once they're on a clinical trial, check in every single day to make sure they're doing okay, provide some early warning signs of adverse events and take away that work from the site. We can have, you know, monitoring of some of the compliance for dosing at home and being able to make sure mm-hmm. a patient's aware of what's happening in terms of eating needs or medication or completing of some of their diaries. We can take all of that work off their plate. And then I think some of the services that's being offered by CROs, big companies, the QVs of the world, those are going to probably change, I think, in the next 10 years. And you're going to see CROs begin to probably outsource or rethink how their actual AI model is going to replace some of the staff. I mean, CROs are all human capital. I think we're going to see a huge constraint and a shift in how we manage clinical trials and provide oversight to patients and the sites and safety monitoring, compliance standards. We can probably automate 70% of the work that's out there today.
You know, when we have these two different guests on, I was asking, well, you know, what are some examples? Because you've got a lot of physicians out here, some listening to us right now, thinking, well, you know, I'm hearing about AI, but where is it? I'm not using it in my daily practice. And we did a podcast with another company, Neurality Health, that is using AI for the call center and the front office and a lot of tasks back office, actually calling insurers and getting work done, even in a multi-call situation. Yeah. And then what you're doing. So it's really, and this is really just 3 months after doing those other podcasts where you're seeing these solutions, or just, we're becoming aware of them anyway. Exciting.
Is anybody else doing what you're doing, Rob?
Not exactly, but I'm sure we're not going to be the only player in this market. I imagine this is going to get, you know, quite busy and saturated. You know, I think staying very, very focused and narrow and being the best at what we can be is important for us as a company. So I imagine there's a lot of AI coming into clinical trials sometime in the near future, if it's already not in place today.
If you build a highly successful company, you know, obviously you're going to grow, but where do you see that going? You know, if there is a purchaser, is it going to be a large CRO, or is it going to be, or do you gain success by contracting with, you know, dozens and dozens of those companies and just staying in your lane?
Yeah, great question. I think our exits, which I haven't thought too much about, to be honest with you, but there's a couple of big conglomerates out there, like the WCGs of the world, the Advaras, which have been buying a lot of e-clinical technologies over the years. That could be a potential suitor for us. Also, some of the big CROs seeing the benefit that they could provide to the sites who are part of their clinical trials could be a great opportunity for us as an exit as well. Kind of in a mental time period, we're planning to think about that in the next 5 to 6 years. So, that seems like the optimal time where we don't get too expensive. There's a lot that people can build onto our platform that we started, and we've got the foundation in place. That seems like the sweet spot in my mind, but only time will tell.
Would it be beneficial if you were to have a partner that had a database of patient information that you could filter through and help train Jane or whatever model you're using? Because we've had a relationship with another entity that has an enormous database of, what, Jeff, you might be able to expand on this, but the healthcare information that we did.
Yeah, it basically came out of Express Scripts. Literally every human adult in America with some, I want to say it's 60 data points per person.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would be very helpful for us. And if we have somehow can get the consent of the patient to communicate with them as well, then we have as much information as we need to help them align probably 50, 75% of the way there to the specific clinical trial. Mm-hmm. So instead of communicating to 10,000 patients around a specific site, we just communicate to 40 that are eligible today, right? Just a much more targeted, efficient communication. And again, overwhelmingly, patients believe clinical trials should be available to them. So, we're aligning with the patient's goals and needs. So absolutely, it'd be very helpful for us.
Well, it's probably going to be something we have to talk about more offline, but this database has literally got millions of users in it. Millions. And Jeff and I are both advisors to this group.
Like that.
What is it, Jeff?
I think it's 330 million.
It's insane.
And they're using the data, I think, in a very fantastic way, just helping organizations fix their data problems. For instance, our MPI database of physicians, it's laden with errors. And so they have a mechanism where insurance company or just a large entity can compare their data. There's no transference, but ID Relate is the name of the company. They can identify where the errors exist based on their vector analysis, which they've recently received a patent for, and help correct those inaccuracies.
That would be great. I mean, I think there's a significant opportunity, right, for us to do that. Instead of having to collect this information directly from the patient, having 70-80% of the information already available from a data set will help us navigate to the right patient more rapidly. Absolutely.
Awesome.
Good. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the financial part of this. I've got your pitch deck right in front of me. I think we've talked a good bit about the technology, at least for the listeners' sake. You're revenue positive. Do you want to talk a little bit about where you think you'll be next year, profitability, that kind of time frame?
Yeah, let me just give a 30-second overview of our business model. So we sell our technology primarily to research sites, which they come in all shapes and sizes, and they pay a monthly recurring revenue of, let's say, $700 to $3,000 per month based on how many studies they have and how many patients they have using our product. Just the revenue model. We have a small commercial team, which is a part of our hiring process now for this particular raise, and we sell it directly to those sites. They typically have a 12, 24, or longer months of bookings for a particular site. And then we ramp up our revenue. So next year we'll do about $1 million in revenue. We'll end the year with about $1.5 million in annual run rate. So as we scale, you know, the December year-end run rate is going to be quite a bit higher than our actual revenue for the year itself. And then we're scaling the business to about $20 million in revenue by 2029. I got a new updated presentation, by the way, than the one you're looking at.
2029, you said how much?
$20 million of revenue.
Okay.
Slightly ahead of the current deck you have now.
Oh, gotcha.
And you know, one of the things I've learned in the clinical trial space is that we just don't want to burn a lot of capital. You need to be very, very efficient. Things take a long time in the beginning with their clinical trial software company. You got to get clients, they onboard, you got new brands and logos to help scale your business. You've got more data about how patients are using it and your impact on enrollment, which is great. So we expect, again, slow growth in the business initially, accelerating that growth through our direct commercial team as well. And we're not expecting to burn a lot of capital as a business. So I founded the company and funded the company personally since inception. This is our first race to market with an $800,000 convertible note. And you know, next year we're only losing like $150,000, kind of cash flow break even in 2026, and then profitable there forward. We just have to lean it. Got to be a very disciplined company in the very beginning stages in the clinical trial space. It's easy to go through a lot of capital very quickly because it takes some time to ramp up the clients for that recurring revenue.
Yeah, it seemed like at this point you've got the product built, just marketing it, distribution, so to speak, would be your biggest cost, right?
Yeah, we're hiring right now. I'm the only sales rep in the company, but we're hiring six sales team members in 2025 to help us scale with those sites.
The 800 note, what valuation is that being offered at?
The current cap is 6.5 million, which I thought was pretty fair, but I've seen things all over the place recently, to be honest.
No, that seems fair to me.
It does. Is that note bearing any interest?
Yep, 5% a year and then a 10% discount on the next financing as well. And you know what's important I've learned, particularly from my past, is that the reason I didn't want to set a high cap, one, I told you reasonable. And I think it's more important to align yourself with the right investors at this stage because they become important pieces of the equation in this business going forward, right? Whether it's discussing this other opportunity, which you just mentioned a few minutes ago, right? They become typical assisted partners in your business in some capacity. Mm-hmm. So building that relationship is more important. Working with the right investor that thinks about your business in the right way is way more important than trying to pull off a $15 million cap. Just, it's kind of doesn't matter. You know, if you're going to be more successful because of this team coming on board as an investor beyond the capital, then that I personally find that much more important than some chasing some valuation.
It's sort of the value of building a company when raising capital is tough. You know, it kind of forces founders to do things the hard way, which might just be the right way.
Yep.
Bootstrap it and actually load clients and get revenue turned on and all the important things. Makes raising capital later a whole lot easier, doesn't it?
It does. And I think you're starting off with a better realistic expectation. You know, if you start creating false expectations to your investors in the beginning phases by having this lofty, huge projections, you know, unreasonable goals, you're building the foundation of failure at that point, right? You're not setting the right expectations in the beginning. So right investors, be reasonable about your business and then put reasonable business model in front of them. That says, look, it's going to take a lot of work in the next 5 or 6 years to pull this off. But when we do, it's going to be successful versus saying we're going to generate $200 million in revenue in 4 years, right? Unrealistic. I've been doing this long enough to tell you, particularly in my industry, things just take a long time. So the business doesn't look that exciting for the first couple of years from a revenue perspective, but you're building the foundation for what is to come a year, five, six, and beyond.
Rob, you talked a little bit about it already, but can you just go back to your other successful ventures? You've had one or two successful exits previously, correct?
Yes. So Pharmatech Oncology was acquired by Tempus. So that company was acquired by Central Research Site Network and then a lab as well. And then Clem1 ended up merging with another company through an exit here about a month ago.
Are we looking at the team?
No, we have a small team in place, but there's something that I learned along the way. So if you look at our deck, we don't have a VP of technology or a CTO. We run on Salesforce Health Cloud because it's a very efficient way cost-wise to build a very scalable product that's very secure, right? Instead of spending $3-4 million building the infrastructure of a product that you have to maintain the security standards for that is very difficult. So we actually outsource everything to our partner in India. So we have a significant cost reduction on an hourly rate for our Salesforce development, which is great. It keeps things very cheap and tidy. And they're experts in what they do. So we found that to be a very effective cost model for us. And the way we built out this model says we don't have to spend a ton of money rebuilding the technology infrastructure. Our value is how many patients we touch, how good our language is with OpenAI, and what revenue we're generating. That's, to me, that's the three key value elements of the business. So I want to keep this company lean. We don't have a, you know, executive team made up of seven individuals that's burning, you know, $1 million a year on payroll, or probably more than that. If I look at some of the companies in the market today, you just got to stay very cost efficient. And a Salesforce of six is more important right now than a full-time CTO. I offshore it. I have a high confidence in our product, a high confidence in our development team. And to me, that makes a lot more sense than spending a lot of money on an internal team.
Does OpenAI have pricing tiers? You mentioned that, and I really hadn't thought about that. But
yeah, great question. So if you look at our cost of goods, you know, we run about a 87-88% gross margin. So 12% of what we generate from revenue goes to two things. One, SMS costs are not inexpensive. It's the preferred method of 98% of patients in the marketplace today. So we want to communicate how patients want it. And the second cost component is going to be the token cost for OpenAI. So, you know, we'll ultimately buy tokens from OpenAI to use their product. So your input language gets a word count, and about 3/4 of a word is a token. And then there's a similar model going out to you on token as well. So you are paying for the actual transaction cost with OpenAI. And then they have different models for the complexity of the language. So we use the 4.0 mini, which means that our calculations cannot be that complex in terms of our analysis. It's a light version of their product with very high response rate and very low latency, but it has limitations on what it can and calculate. And there's more sophisticated models that you can buy, and those tokens tend to be much more expensive as well. Things I never thought I'd learn about, paying tokens for artificial intelligence.
Yeah,
I've never understood that model. So that's great to hear how that's done.
Well, Rob, is there anything that we haven't discussed that you think would be important to a user of the platform or an investor?
Yeah, I think we did a really good job, and you helped kind of coach the road here to make sure we're covering all the bases. I hope I covered everything in terms of the product and the business itself. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to jump on this podcast with the both of you and helping expand my reach into other parts of the team here.
Well, absolutely. Well, thanks for joining us. This Rob Bohawks with Researchify Health. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff Brown, with my co-host, Dr. Jeff Cole, for the Merge Medical Podcast. Thanks, everybody.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.